Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's Your Call, we continue our week-long series on the U.S. prison system by following the money. With 2.2 million people behind bars, the U.S. spends $80 billion a year on the federal and state prison system. The epidemic of mass incarceration has resulted in huge profits for a wide array of corporations. You've got the private prison companies, Corrections Corporation of America, and the GEO Group. These are the two largest for-profit prison companies in the U.S. They made $3.3 billion in annual revenue in 2012, making up 75% of the prison industry, but only 10% of the entire prison industry. So we often hear about the privatization of prisons. But what about other corporations making money off of prisons? Banks, construction firms, the companies that most of us have never heard of. Who is profiting from the prison system? Today, we will follow the money and look at the vested interests opposing change from corporations to politicians. Today, we are joined by James Kilgore, a writer and activist. His latest book is Understanding Mass Incarceration, A People's Guide to the Key Civil Rights Struggle of Our Era. James was incarcerated for 6.5 years in federal and state prisons in California, and he joins us from Ohio. Hi, James. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Rose. How are you today?
Good. Thank you for joining us. We're also joined by Paul Wright, founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center, a nonprofit that advocates on behalf of the human rights of people held in U.S. detention facilities. Paul Wright is editor of Prison Legal News, the longest-running independent prisoner rights publication in the U.S. He's co-authored three anthologies, including Prison Profiteers, Who Makes Money from Mass Imprisonment. Paul was incarcerated for 17 years in Washington State, and he joins us from Florida. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's great to have you. So this is a huge topic. $80 billion a year is spent on the prison systems in the United States. And James, let's start off with you, because when we think about who's profiting off of prisons, we often think about the private prison industry. But you say that's just a slice of the percentage it's basically 10% of the prison industry overall, and we shouldn't really focus our efforts on the private prisons.
Well, I think it's good to focus, to give some focus to the private prisons. After all, they are profiteers, and I mean, their business is a fairly despicable one, making profits off of locking people up and making more money out of locking up more people for longer periods of time. But I think I think in some ways they're soft targets. If you look at the figures that you gave in the opening, their annual revenue is less than half of the annual budget for the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. So there's a lot of other companies involved that are taking in some of that $80 billion a year. So, for example, we have some massive construction companies who have been involved in building prisons across this country. To give you an example, the Players Turner Construction, for example, they built the Lincoln Center, but they also specialize in prisons. They made about $300 million a year from 2007 to 2012 in building prisons. In California, we found in the 1990s there were 9 medium and high security prisons that were built, each at a cost of about $200 million. And along with the construction companies, we found that these were financed through revenue bonds, and these revenue bonds were underwritten by big players in global finance, the late and not-so-great Lehman Brothers, along with Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs and so forth. So there's that set of players, and then there's a whole range of service providers who have fairly huge contracts to provide things like health care, food, phone services, and these are more or less monopolized by a few companies across the country who contract with state departments of corrections and local jails to provide these services at enormous profits.
And so is there any one place where we can find all of these names and really follow the money to find out how this money is actually being spent?
Well, it takes a little bit of digging around, because a lot of these companies are not private are not public companies, so they hide their financial records. But I think one place, and I think Paul can add on to this, one place where we find a lot of information about these corporations is in the Prison Legal News, which has done a lot of innovative journalism and has also initiated legal action against companies like Horizon Healthcare, which makes about $1.5 billion a year through its contracts with 28 state prisons.
And Paul, what would you add to this bigger question about where we should focus our attention? Again, even when you read about prisons and how the money is spent, the private prisons come up pretty regularly, and then there are some stories about prison labor. But where do you think, what do you think the focus should be when we're talking about how this $80 billion is spent every year?
Well, one thing, first off, is that $80 billion is deceptively low, and that's not a complete number. That's only the operating cost. The $80 to $90 billion a year that's spent on prisons, those are only the on-the-books numbers for operating costs. That doesn't count all the interest payments that are being spent on the revenue bonds that were built to build prisons. And just to put some numbers in mind, is since 1980, the United States has spent over $1 trillion. That's trillion with a TR on building prisons and jails. I mean, that's a huge investment, and that's part of it. It also doesn't count the pensions and the benefits for the prison employees. And I think part of the thing is that some of the bigger impacts that prisons have that no one really talks about are, first off, it distorts labor markets in the United States. You've got 2.5 million people in the United States. If they weren't in prison, presumably would be looking for a job, and a job that isn't there. And then one of the things that I think also makes it so hard to really talk seriously about prison reform or criminal justice reform in this country is you've got the million-plus people that draw a paycheck every week from the act of incarcerating and caging other people. This is everyone from the prison guards, the secretaries, the prison doctors, the bloated bureaucracies that shuffle papers around, and everything else. So in some respects, mass incarceration has also become a vast jobs program. Mm. So when we're talking about the $90 billion a year, $80 billion a year that's actually spent on operating the prisons, not taking into account the cost of building them and pensions and things like that, that kind of gives you an idea on where a lot of the money is actually going. And I think that's also one of the questions, too, is that some people use the term prison industrial complex, which I've never really liked that term, because I think when you use the word industrial, it kind of implies that something of value is being produced. And the prison system, about the only thing it produces is a lot of misery and desperation and dehumanization, which, as we're discussing, some people may profit off of it, but I don't think anyone's going to say that's a value. And I think when you're having this discussion, I think the bigger point is this money is coming from somewhere, and every penny that's being spent on incarcerating people, whether it's going to a private prison company or to a government prison or wherever, these are all tax dollars. And in a world of finite resources, it's where that money is being prioritized and how it's being spent. And every dollar is being spent on a prison is money that can't be spent on something else. And I think that one of the things that's interesting is people usually don't see the connection between mass incarceration and their everyday lives. I think especially people that if they haven't been in prison themselves or one of their loved ones or immediate family members are not in prison, they think, well, gosh, you know, this doesn't affect me. But actually, it affects all of us. And I think one of the things, especially in a big state like California, they spend $7 or $8 billion a year directly on their prison system. And what the prison system and the criminal justice system is doing is it's a really good way of taking public wealth in the form of tax dollars and redistributing it to a lot of private players and among others, and as a form of a jobs program. And I think that one of the things is when I hear students and I hear people in their 30s complaining about how high their student loans are, how much student debt they accrued, and it's kind of like, huh, well, I wonder if they ever made the connection that as states pulled back the amount of money they were spending on higher education to spend it on prisons instead, that's what results in higher student debt, because that subsidy basically is the money that students were getting 20 years ago. Now it goes into the prisons. Mm-hmm. And people don't make a lot of these connections, is that the money that's being spent on building prisons is money that's not available for things like higher education, buildings, public buildings, infrastructure like roads and bridges, and things like that. So in some respects, these are actually pretty hard policy choices that have already been made, and it's really hard to unmake them.
Well, this came up on yesterday's show, looking at how we got here. And according to California Common Sense, since 1980, higher education spending has decreased by 13% in inflation-adjusted dollars, whereas spending on California's prisons has skyrocketed by 436%. They also point out that correctional officers in California typically make somewhere between 50 and 90% more than comparable jobs in the rest of the country. So, James, what role do prison unions play here?
Well, I think California is one of the most extreme. The CCPOA, the Union of Prison Guards, has been an active campaigner both to maintain their own economic position. And I should point out that thousands of prison guards in California earn over $100,000 a year, largely by working huge amounts of overtime and doing all kinds of scams to arrange their schedules to maximize their payment. But the union itself is a very politically active force, and they have put huge amounts of money into gubernatorial campaigns to make sure that whoever gets into the governor's office is going to be pro-prison, pro-incarceration. They've also been big advocates for harsher sentencing laws, things like, you know, the California's classic three strikes law and truth in sentencing laws and so forth. And they've also funded victims' rights organizations, which have become very outspoken in terms of pushing for harsher sentencing and more prison and jail building. So I think that union itself is a very important player. The New York Prison Guards Union has played a similar role, and we've seen even in other states like Illinois, where I live, we've seen the unions actively oppose prison closures. And the classic example was TAMS, which is a supermax. It's sort of the Pelican Bay of Illinois. And the governor issued an executive order to close it down, and the Union of the Prison Guards organized a massive campaign to oppose it. And although the union didn't succeed, they delayed the closure by more than a year. And now that we have a Scott Walker clone for governor, Bruce Rauner, he's once again talking about reopening it, and the unions are stepping forward. So although some of the unions are now beginning to rethink their position on mass incarceration, over the course of the expansion of prisons and jails, unions have been big players in terms of advocating expansion of carceral facilities.
And Paul, what would you add about the power of the prison unions and the role they play?
Well, I think it's one of those things, it's like a lot of things, it varies widely from state to state. As James notes, California is a state where the guards union is extremely strong. In other states, especially in the Northeast, like New Jersey, Pennsylvania, New York, again, we've got very strong guards unions. And I think this is also a case, too, where the public interest is basically being subordinated to the individual financial interests of guards and the people that are directly employed. And I think it's one of those things that's happened in this country is for the last 30 years, a lot of the massive prison expansion that we've seen has just been nakedly promoted as a jobs program, especially for poor white rural communities. And instead of asking the discussion of, does the United States really need to have the highest incarceration rate in the world, and is public safety and social policy by having this many people incarcerated? Instead, it gets reframed as, gosh, the jobs have left these rural areas where these poor white folks live, so let's build a prison and we can give them all jobs as prison guards. And instead, the prison is being seen as a tool of economic development on the backs of typically it's urban and poor residents. So that's, I think, you know, part of the problem. And but in general, though, in most of the country, especially where guards unions are parts of bigger municipal and state employee unions like AFSCME and things like that, you don't see that big of an impact. They're more concerned about their worker issues, you know, like compensation and benefits and things like that. It's only been more where we've got, it tends to be only more where we've got unions like in California and a few other places, which fortunately are few, where the guards union is spun off as its own separate entity and just representing prison and jail guards, that they're more politically active.
That is Paul Wright. He is founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and editor of Prison Legal News. He has co-authored three anthologies, including Prison Profiteers, Who Makes Money from Mass Imprisonment. Paul was incarcerated for 17 years in Washington State. We're also joined by James Kilgore, writer, activist, and author of Understanding Mass Incarceration, A People's Guide to the Key Civil Rights Struggle of Our Era. James was incarcerated for 6.5 years in federal and state prisons in California. And today we are continuing our week-long series on the U.S. prison system. Today we are following the money. As we've been talking about, the private prison companies get a lot of attention in the media, but today's guests say it is important, but that's 10% of all prisons across the country. We really need to also talk about the banks, the construction firms, the companies that so many of us have never heard of. So today we are following the money and looking at the vested interests opposing real reform from corporations to politicians. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What questions do you have about the prison industry? $80 billion a year, but our guests say that's probably a low number. And what are your thoughts on what you've been reading in the media about prison labor, about the privatization of prisons? What questions do you have? And if you work on any of these issues, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So let's talk a little bit about politicians and the role that they play. The Intercept just ran an article called Private Prison Lobbyists Are Raising Cash for Hillary Clinton. Li Fang reports that recently President Clinton and other candidates had to reveal the lobbyists who are serving as bundlers for their campaign. And he found that Richard Sullivan of the lobbying firm Capital Counselor is a bundler for the Clinton campaign, also a registered lobbyist for the GEO Group. They also report that five Clinton bundlers work for a lobbying and law firm that is has been hired by the Corrections Corporation of America, the largest private prison company in America. James, what are your thoughts on this, and what else do we need to know about the connection between politicians and the companies that make money off of the prison system?
Well, I think we need to realize that mass incarceration has been one of the great bipartisan projects of the modern era. So Democrats and Republicans have been backing this for economic reasons. In some cases, in rural constituencies, they've been doing it in order with promises of job creation. And there's been very little opposition to prison expansion across the board. Now I find it really interesting that somehow Hillary Clinton is trying to distance herself from the fact that the U.S. built more prisons and expanded the prison system more during her husband's presidency than during the years of Ronald Reagan. And I watched her last night in an interview with some activists from Black Lives Matter, and she was ducking and dodging their questions because they were really pushing her on this issue. And it's quite clear that she's trying to do some kind of a cosmetic cover-up, issue some half-hearted apology, but what is going to be the real concrete action that she's going to support, and how much contrition does she really feel about what's happened? I mean, mass incarceration is now becoming a buzzword. It's now becoming very fashionable to be against mass incarceration, but what does that really mean? I want to hear from politicians some concrete ways in which they're going to make changes. Now we're hearing them talk solely about releasing people with nonviolent offenses, releasing people who are innocent, releasing people who are old and ill. And this is all positive, but that's really just making a very small dent in the population that's behind bars right now. So we need some much more comprehensive proposals, and I don't think we're going to get these from politicians in the absence of a social movement that can pressure them and make that change happen.
James, what do you think about the fact that various liberal groups and, you know, high-profile liberals like Van Jones are working with conservatives like Grover Norquist and Newt Gingrich on these issues and calling for reforms and calling to decrease the prison population? James, what do you think about that?
Well, I have a very personal connection to this. I lived through the transition from apartheid to democracy in South Africa in the early 1990s. And one of the connections, and I connect that to this period, in the early 1990s, it was almost impossible to find a white person that claimed that they had supported apartheid. Everyone was on board for a so-called reconciliation, for a so-called bipartisan solution. But here we are 20 years later, and there's been very little change in the distribution of wealth. In fact, South Africa is a more unequal society than it was in at the end of apartheid. So I'm very concerned that this bipartisan unity approach is really not going to take us very far. It's very difficult now to find anyone who says they actually supported mass incarceration, or that will admit that they wholeheartedly backed it, and they certainly don't think it's a good idea now. So I'm a little bit concerned that this bipartisan unity approach is going to give us a piecemeal reform which might reduce our prison population by 10% or 15%, but will fail to address the real problem, the roots of the problem, which are poverty and inequality. That mass incarceration has not been a solution to crime, but mass incarceration has been linked to rising poverty, inequality, homelessness, and so forth, and the stripping away of social services to provide state support for people in the more marginalized sectors of the working class. So I'm very concerned that this is going to be a temporary kind of solution that's not going to really get at the roots of the problem, and that people who have been active on this issue are going to be seduced by the rhetoric and not really look behind what solutions are being proposed and what are the ways in which resources need to be reallocated. Because one of the things that's happening in the bipartisan approach is that cutting back on mass incarceration is being put forward as a money saver, that we're going to cut costs and cut cutting corrections budgets. But the fact is that we cannot reverse what's the damage that's done by mass incarceration without both decarcerating hundreds of thousands of people.
And hold that thought, James. We're going to take a quick break. Today we are continuing our week-long series on the U.S. prison system by following the money. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Lots of ways to join in today's conversation on Your Call with Rose Aguilar. On the phone or by sending an email. The address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can simply leave a message if you like at the website, yourcallradio.org. If you want to join us live on the air, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, World Have Your Say. Following that at noon, it's Philosophy Talk with John Perry and Ken Taylor. And then at 1, from the SETI Institute in Mountain View, Big Picture Science. All here on Local Public Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Tomorrow, we will continue our week-long series on the U.S. prison system by talking about the long-term impacts of youth who spend time behind bars. The juvenile incarceration rate is at its lowest level since 1975, but the U.S. still locks up youth at very high rates compared to similarly governed countries. The vast majority are behind bars for nonviolent offenses. So what happens to young people once they get entangled in the juvenile justice system? And what happens to young people who spend time in solitary confinement? That is tomorrow. On Thursday, we will have a conversation about what real reform looks like. Friday, we'll talk about media coverage of these issues. Today, we are following the money. With 2.2 million people behind bars, the U.S. spends $80 billion a year on the federal and state prison systems. The private prison corporations get quite a bit of attention in the media. Corrections Corporations of America and the GEO Group. These are the two largest for-profit prison companies. They make about $3 billion in annual revenue, and they make up 75% of the private prison industry, but only 10% of the entire prison industry. So today's guests say that while that's important to talk about, we also have to talk about the companies most of us have never heard of, the banks that are profiting off of this, the construction firms. There's a lot of companies involved in this making money that most of us haven't heard of. And we're talking about this today with James Kilgore, writer and activist, author of Understanding Mass Incarceration. James was incarcerated for 6.5 years in California federal and state prisons. Paul Wright is founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and editor of Prison Legal News. He is author of Prison Profiteers, Who Makes Money from Mass Imprisonment. Paul was incarcerated for 17 years in Washington State. And you can join us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Susan in Foster City. Hi, Susan. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much, and I want to thank today's guests, and thank you for just bringing this to the public light. One of the things that I've been considering for many years is the numbers of people in prison who are aging in prison and will eventually die in prison, and there was a film made about a year and a half ago on HBO called Prison Terminal by Edgar Behrens that highlights sort of the dilemma of a prison in Iowa and prisoners caring for each other at end of life, and it's an incredible film to see, and it sort of points at a huge issue that's going to be happening at the same rate the baby boomers are aging out. The same thing is happening to tens of thousands of people in prison, and there seems to be no solution or even idea that this is going to be happening and happening now.
Well, thank you. I mean, we could do an entire show about that, people aging in prison. Paul or James, do you want to comment on that?
Well, I think it's obvious that keeping people who are elderly in prison is a very dehumanizing practice, and I think it's an obvious situation that needs immediate attention. How we can be keeping people in prison 30 or 40 years after they've committed their crimes when they really pose no danger at all to public safety and are probably costing people hundreds of thousands of taxpayer dollars each year is beyond me. However, I do want to issue a word of caution, and that is if we release people, we need to make sure that they have some kind of support when they're put onto the streets. We can't just open the gates and push people out in wheelchairs and think somehow that's going to solve the problem.
Right, and we will discuss that on Thursday when we talk about reform. So thank you for calling in, and I will add this to our show idea list. Thanks for calling, Susan. Let's go next to Maro in Santa Cruz. Hi, Maro. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm calling because tomorrow a particular bill called that's numbered SB 124, which has to do with juvenile solitary confinement, is going to the Assembly Appropriations Committee, and will be put in something called suspense, which means that it could die. It's gone through the state Senate, and it's passed there. It's gone through the Assembly Public Safety Committee, and it's going to be stuck in the Appropriations Committee, in part because the prison guards who and the probation officers are against it. They're against it because right now they have freedom to lock kids away for 23 hours a day, 7 days a week, for months on end. If they choose to, there's no controls over it. There are no standards around it, and they don't have to report. So there's no accountability. This is a really important bill. It certainly is piecemeal, but it's the kind of bill that needs to go to the governor's office, and the governor needs to sign it. And I think what's happening right now is just what the speakers have been talking about, which is that the prison guards and the probation officers see their power being taken away, and they don't want this bill to pass. What can we as citizens do to make sure these reforms are implemented and that kids are protected? And I know this is a topic for tomorrow, but since it's going to be heard in appropriations tomorrow, since this bill is going to be heard in appropriations tomorrow, I'd like to get the word out today.
Yes, thank you so much for calling in about that, and we will definitely talk about it tomorrow. Paul, do you want to comment on this?
Yes, I think that one of the things is that in the rest of the world, prolonged solitary confinement is considered a human rights violation. It's condemned by international treaties, and yet here in the here in the United States, it's extremely widespread on a given day, and 80, 90,000 people are being held in solitary confinement, often for years and decades on end. And as there's starting to be some movement on reform around this issue, it's starting out with children who are also being placed in solitary confinement. And I think one of the biggest things is when we have government officials denying that people are being held in solitary confinement, even though by any reasonable definition of the term they are. I think it's very positive that the legislature in California is undertaking a bill to ban it, and I hope it passes.
The San Francisco Chronicle had an editorial about this, pointing out that Contra Costa County recently settled a federal lawsuit brought by two disability rights groups against its juvenile hall's use of solitary. They had to pay $2 million in legal fees. Young inmates were being put in a 12-by-12-foot cell for up to 23 hours a day. And so SB 124, authored by State Senator Mark Leno, cleared the Senate on a 26-13 vote, the Assembly Public Safety Committee on a 5-2 vote, and as we just heard, it'll be heard now in the Assembly Appropriations Committee. So thanks again for that. And thanks for raising awareness about that issue. We've got a couple of emails on this issue. Margot writes in, can you please talk about the goods and services provided by prisoners and how much they get paid for producing those goods and services and whether they are for-profit companies or the state? Paul, do you want to take that one first?
Sure. I think that we've got prison industries. We have two types. We have the ones where they work for the state, and they produce everything from license plates to furniture for state agencies. And then we have the ones where they work for private companies. The private companies, I think, probably garner the lion's share of the media attention, but the numbers are extremely small. We've got basically around 5,000 to 6,000 prisoners working for private companies at any given time, and then around 70,000 nationally working for government-run prison industries. And one of the things that's interesting is, as we've reported extensively in Prison Legal News over the years, is that the prisoners that are working for the government-run prison industries, typically these are heavily subsidized by the government, and even though they pay their prisoners little or nothing, they're still losing money. And even the prisoners are working for the private companies, typically none of these private prison prison industries programs, whether for private companies or for the government, can exist except for massive government subsidies. They're not profitable, and they don't make money. They're just a boondoggle on taxpayers.
And James, what are your thoughts on this? We got a couple of emails about the California fires. Over 4,400 prisoners housed at 42 inmate fire camps are fighting California's fires. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, these are jobs that that normally would be done by civilians. And as Paul has pointed out, still the numbers who are involved in this kind of activity are quite small. I think the important thing to recognize is that almost everyone who's in prison who's healthy has a job, but the jobs are basically keeping the prison going. So that might be working in the kitchen, maintaining the yard, cleaning the buildings. You have some people who are very skilled electricians or skilled in other building trades who do a lot of work to keep the prisons going, and that's somewhere around 750,000 people who are involved in these kinds of jobs who are typically paid very, very little, maybe 5 cents an hour, 10 cents an hour. I think on my first job in prison, I got 10 cents an hour to work in the kitchen. Sometimes in kitchens, you just get paid with food. So the vast majority of people who are working in prisons are working to keep the institutions going, which basically raises the issue, wouldn't it just be better if they weren't there in the first place? So rather than fighting to get them minimum wage or union working conditions, let's figure out ways to get them out in the street and being productive members of their community.
And Captain Jorge Santana with the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation told BuzzFeed that the prisoners who are fighting California's fires are saving the state over $1 billion a year. I'm noticing this is getting a lot of attention on social media. The other thing that got a lot of attention earlier this month was about Whole Foods and alternate reports that Colorado prisoners grow 1.2 million pounds of tilapia a year for Whole Foods, and these prisoners make about $1.50 per hour. And this just got a lot of attention on social media. You know, actually, it was Counterpunch, I'm sorry. The headline is Whole Foods exploits prison labor for your goodies while ripping you off. What do you think about these kinds of stories that gain so much traction, Paul?
Well, I think it's one of those things that also kind of expose, I think, the notion that somehow prison slavery is helping prisoners and just exploiting them. I think that's something that needs to be addressed, because some of the prisons and some of the companies try to portray themselves as, engaging in some beneficial act here by enslaving prisoners and exploiting their labor. But I think one of the things that is often overlooked is when we're talking about the California prisoners being used as firefighters, the Colorado prisoners being exploited by Whole Foods, which if anyone who's ever shopped at Whole Foods lately, you're certainly not seeing any savings on your grocery bill just because Whole Foods is employing prisoners at a buck an hour or whatever. And I think that the big thing to keep in mind about that is this is how prison slavery depresses wages and drives down wages. Because one of the things to think about, if the 4,000 prisoners in California that are being used to fight fires were not being used at $1 an hour or $1 a day or however much they're getting paid, those jobs would have to be filled by non-prisoners who are being paid whatever the prevailing wage is, whether it's $15 or $20 an hour, and benefits. And that's one of the key things, is the prisoners typically have no benefits. They don't get vacations. They don't get health insurance. They don't get unemployment. It's the ultimate at-will third world slave labor task force. And that's what the prisons typically exploit and use. But I think that, like I say, the bigger question here is how it depresses the wages of everyone, not just those people in prison. And I think that's been the most the worst effect that prison slavery has had in the country in modern times.
And James, what would you add to that?
I totally agree with all the points that Paul is making, and I think, but maybe just to extend it to the larger pool of prison workers who are working for the institution, that these people are doing jobs for which they're getting no training, they're gaining very little, if any, skills. So there's nothing that they're actually doing that's going to be. It's going to enable them to actually gain employment when they get onto the streets. So I think this is part of what the project of mass incarceration has done, is that it has warehoused people, and typically the jobs that people do to maintain the institution are maybe 2, 3, 4 hours a day, and the rest of the time there's just very little for people for people to do. And one of the big changes that's happened during the era of mass incarceration has been the stripping away of programs of job training and education so that people are coming out of prison with no marketable skills and being thrown back into the job market with a felony conviction on top of it.
And according to BuzzFeed and other reports, prisoners who are fighting California's fire are making less than $2 per day, which goes to our next question. That does not even give them enough money to make a phone call. We've got a question also about the how much it costs to make a phone call, and can you also talk about the phone companies that are profiting from this? And so this is a $1.2 billion a year industry. At the rate of $1.13 per minute, it costs about $17 to make a 15-minute phone call. And Global Tel Link is one of the big players. Paul, what else can you tell us about the phone call industry behind bars?
Well, basically, the phone call industry behind bars is it's a total monopoly racket, and it exists, and it's abetted by prison and jail officials. What we see is that what drives the cost of the phone calls is the kickbacks that these telecoms give to government agencies in exchange for these exclusive monopoly contracts. And I think that's one of the things is that this whole notion that consumers have or should have freedom of choice or whatever is totally on its head and just not even given lip service to in the prison or jail context. It's basically a hostage situation where people that are being kept at gunpoint in prisons or jails, if their loved ones want to communicate with them, they have to go through the telephone companies that have been given these monopoly contracts by the prison and jail. And in exchange for that monopoly contract, they get a cut of the action in the form of commissions, lump sum payments, or you know, any of the many different names of that they call it. And this is pretty much the norm and has been in the last 30 years. And a couple of states to their credit, including California at the state level, but not at the jail level, the states of New York, New Mexico, and a few other states have done away with the kickbacks. And they've seen the cost of the calls go down immensely. But this has not happened in the majority of the states, and as far as we know, there's only one or two jails in the entire United States that don't take kickbacks from the telecom industry. But this is another example of where it's the government that's basically creating the situation through these monopoly contracts with the sole purpose of exploiting consumers who have a loved one in prison.
Can you explain how the kickbacks work?
Sure. So the government tells the telecom providers, we're going to give a monopoly contract, whoever is going to give us the biggest kickback or percentage of the action. The state of Arizona recently signed a contract, I believe it was with Securus, where in exchange for the monopoly telephone contract, Securus is going to give them 94% of all the phone rate commissions they bring in. So for every dollar that someone is paying to talk to a loved one in prison in Arizona, the DOC is going to get 94 cents of that.
Wow.
So, and in some places, I mean, it's in a lot of places, the amounts of money are pretty huge. They're millions, tens of millions of dollars, which in the context of overall prison and jail budgets, the amount is minuscule, but in terms of the pocketbooks of poor people and working people, it's a huge amount of money.
Exactly. And the Center for Public Integrity had an investigation about a private company in Florida called JPay, and they handle all deposits into inmates' accounts. So they had a story about a mom sending her son $50. The mom had to pay $7 to JPay.
Exactly.
Right. And so these fees can be as high as 45% just to send a loved one some money.
Correct. And that's just another aspect. And again, Securus, the telephone, one of the prison telephone companies, as I was mentioning, recently purchased JPay for $250 million to be able to exploit a wider sector of the prison population and monetize and continue monetizing human contact.
Could James, the center also expose the fact that in many cases these are no-bid contracts. Can you talk about how that works and then the politicians, the role they play to actually give these companies this lucrative business?
Yeah, but before I do that, I want to just say one thing about the prison phone situation, because I think it's maybe Paul is being modest, but he's been involved for years in a national campaign to reduce the prison phone charges and to expose the practices of the companies like GlobalTel Link and Securus. And there has been success. The FCC has reduced the charges for out of state calls, and they're presently looking at the reducing the charges for in-state calls as well. And this has been the product not only of campaigning by activists, but by letters and communication from more than 17,000 people who are directly affected by overcharging of prison phone calls. So I think it's an important campaign, and while I've noted the limitations of campaigns, these are campaigns that have the possibility of mobilizing people for further action to deal with these issues. No bid contracts are basically a tool of corruption. I think one of the interesting sidelights to this is the fact that many of the private prisons, part of their contracts also include mandatory occupancy payments. So when they sign their agreement, they're paid per day per bed, and they're guaranteed payment for a minimum of a certain percentage of the beds. In some places, it's up to 100%, 90%. The average is about 65% nationwide. That is, even if the prison is entirely empty, the state will have to pay the charges for a 65% full prison.
We talked earlier about these groups that are getting involved together, like the Koch brothers, Van Jones, Newt Gingrich, these various groups. And James, you didn't get a chance to jump in on that one. What are your thoughts on that? And just the fact that prison reform is now getting so much attention in this country. Do you think that that'll eventually trickle down and raise awareness about the issues that we're talking about today?
Well, I think it can go one of two ways. It can grow and it can expand the awareness, and that can lead to the building of some kind of a social movement that can lead to a transformative change. And for me, the transformative change is not simply getting people out of jails and prisons, but it's also about reallocating the funds that have gone to mass incarceration into the communities that have been decimated by this. Prisons and jails have been the major public housing projects of the past 2.5 decades. We need to see more money that's spent on corrections go back into those, as well as into places like higher education, which we talked about before. But I don't think that's an inevitable course. The having partnerships with the likes of Newt Gingrich and Grover Norquist kind of puts a limit on what we can really expect from that kind of bipartisan unity, because they will obviously oppose any kind of program that fundamentally restructures state allocations and charts a bigger role for the state in terms of welfare provision. So I think it's important that people that are active, who are active on these issues, maintain independent organizations and social movements that can continue to pressure this, rather than being too quick to jump on a bipartisan unity bandwagon, only to find that down the road compromises are made that give us just a very small number of prisoners and jail and people in jail released, and don't really fundamentally transform mass incarceration.
Are you hopeful because these issues are getting so much attention in the national media?
Oh, absolutely, because we've seen, those of us who have been campaigning on this for a long time have been, we've been talking to ourselves a lot, or we've been hollering into the wilderness. So now all of a sudden, when you say mass incarceration, people actually know what it means. So it's a wonderful, burgeoning of consciousness. And I'm also hopeful that it will have a strong connection with the rise of Black Lives Matter, because obviously the racialized character of mass incarceration, with particularly the disproportionate number of African Americans behind bars, throws out great possibilities for building a social movement that can address this issue effectively.
And final thoughts from you, Paul. Are you Are you heartened by, or at least are you hopeful, based on the conversation that prison reform is getting in this country?
Not really, because so far it just seems to be a lot of rhetoric that I think in some respects demobilizes people, because I was reporting on the rise of mass incarceration throughout the 90s when it was happening, when the United States was building a new prison every 2 weeks or so, and every year legislatures around the country, especially in California at the congressional level, they're passing dozens if not hundreds of laws every year that were lengthening sentences, stripping rights from prisoners, ensuring a more punitive, totalitarian criminal justice police state, which is what we have today. And despite all the rhetoric, no one's talking about repealing any of those laws. No one's talking about changing the laws that have filled our prisons. No one's talking about changing or repealing laws like the Prison Litigation Reform Act or the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act that have stripped the courts of the ability to adjudicate claims by prisoners. We're not actually seeing any actual change. I mean, in the 90s, when things were being clamped down and things our prison population literally doubled from 1 million in 1990 to 2 million in 2000, there was a lot of rhetoric and there was a lot of action going on. And right now we hear a lot of rhetoric, but there's no action. So, and I think that what this does is I think this breeds a sense of complacency with people where they're like, well, gosh, we got some politicians, none of whom are in office, actually, and none of whom are actually advancing legislation or introducing legislation or determining budget priorities on this stuff. There's a lot of talk, so therefore we don't need to do anything.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time, but I want to thank both of you for joining us. Paul Wright and James Kilgore, thank you both for joining us. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. What are the long-term impacts of youth who spend time behind bars? On the next Your Call, we'll continue our week-long series on the prison system by talking about young people in jail. While the juvenile incarceration rate is at its lowest level since 1975, the U.S. still locks up youth at very high rates, and the vast majority are behind bars for nonviolent offenses. So what happens to kids once they get entangled in the juvenile justice system? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihei Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.